My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. One of my favorite songs by Justin Hayward and Ray Thomas of the Moody Blues is Are You Sitting Comfortably?, a transcendent, meditative piece from the 1969 album On the Threshold of a Dream. Backed by a soothing blend of Thomas's flute, Hayward's guitar, and Mike Pinder's mellotron, the lyric invited us to take a magical journey to an ancient time. It said, "Ride along the winds of time and see where we have been. The glorious age of Camelot, when Guinevere was queen. It all unfolds before your eyes as Merlin casts his spell." What if we could be magically transported back to those days of chivalry, romance, magic, and adventure? What if Camelot were here and now? My guest this evening, Carmel Nyland, gives us this gift with a little bit of a twist in the first novel in her series of Merlin Secrets. It's called A Darker Magic This Way Comes. Carmel, a true Renaissance woman, is as fascinating a character as the ones she creates. In public, Carmel has been a formidable leader, a CEO working for the largest state government of Australia, heading multifaceted agencies that champion gender and racial equality, human rights, child protection, and disability services. In private, she's been fascinated with historical legends, particularly the tales of King Arthur and his famed magician Merlin. For decades, Merlin captivated her imagination. Blending her keen interest in the Arthurian legend with a passion for Roman-British archaeology, Carmel devoured every piece of literature she could get her hands on and visited every Iron Age and Roman fort in England, Scotland, and Wales, crossing hill and dale and climbing fortifications associated with Arthur. This desire for knowledge about the once and future king compelled her to use her research to reimagine his and Merlin's story. Now she has created her first novel based upon the ancient legends. A Darker Magic This Way Comes is the first book in a series of five for readers who, like her, love secrets, mysteries, something strange and wonderful. Carmel resides in Sydney with her husband John and share a wondrous garden at Mount Victoria in the Blue Mountains. She's also president of the Iris Society of Australia. Please join me in welcoming Carmel Nyland. Good evening, Carmel.
Good evening, Victor. Lovely to hear you.
And thank you so much for joining us. You know, with all of your accomplishments and activities, you really must have tapped into Merlin's magic.
I have spent a long time with Merlin. And you know where I first met him?
Where?
I first met him in Ithaca, New York, teaching grade 8 at DeWitt Junior High School in the magical 60s and 70s.
Wonderful.
And the enthusiasm of my very bright students, as you can well imagine, they had a mother, a professor at Ithaca College, and a father, a professor at Cornell, and vice versa. They were full of questions, and they are always in my heart, and I wrote as everything for them. So young adults who love something strange.
That's wonderful that you're only a few hours away from where I am in New York here.
I could almost walk there. You know, I'm an Australian. You know, we call that close.
Absolutely. And that was in the 60s and 70s.
That's right.
Wonderful.
Yes, the time. The death of Martin Luther King, the death of Robert Kennedy, the man on the moon, the Chicago Convention, Kent State, all of those things happening at a tumultuous time. And they affected my whole being.
Absolutely.
And I'm very interested to see what's happening now with young people again on the streets, because I know in 30, 40 years, they'll still have the taste of that in their mouths.
Absolutely. Now, have you always been a romantic at heart?
I've always been a romantic at heart, and I've always had a kind of quirky scientific inquiry that went with it, because I was never interested in the reality that was presented to me. I was always more interested in the why is that being presented, and what is it? It's a quest, you know. It's a questioner. So it's not only an interest in things metaphysical, but it's an interesting thing like, okay, I'm interested in metaphysics, but what are the questions here, and what are the who are the people who are answering these questions rather than describing the phenomena?
Absolutely. And it's also an absorption of the energy that comes along with all of these facts.
It is, yes.
Now, here across the pond, there have been many television presentations speculating on the legend, and recently one featuring British author Graham Phillips, who claims to have found evidence of the historical Arthur. You've done your own extensive research and exploration. What have you found?
What I found is, where there's smoke, there's fire. And because I concentrate on Merlin, who's the ultimate trickster, he's like Leonardo da Vinci, brilliant, a genius, but with a wand. So if you can imagine the kind of person who could create, who could dredge harbours, recreate harbours, build castles, and we'll put that in inverted commas because they were more like forts than castles. And if he could do that, he was also the ultimate communicator. So I became fascinated with him. And then through him came to Arthur. But one of the key questions about Arthur is not only the quest for the Grail and did he really exist historically, but it's also the fact that the Arthurian story is about the return of Arthur. And that gave me the clue, the return of Arthur as a person totally and completely committed to reincarnation. Who was he? Where is he now? When's he coming back, and how's it going to happen? So I took all of that and asked those questions and came up with my own answers to it. I believe Arthur was a historical character. I believe Merlin was a historical character. Their footprints are there if you know where to look for them.
And of course, be they historical or legendary or mythical, some of the qualities and some of the concepts and ideas are timeless and certainly needed in a time such as we live in.
Definitely. Merlin, clever man that he was a brilliant communicator. But not having at his fingertips the kinds of things we have to communicate with, he had to develop a different way to get out the story of Arthur and his knights and their loves and their pursuits and their quests. He had to get across those, and he had to get across them in a unique way. Merlin had to gather together all the existing troubadours or bards, mm-hmm. of Wales, and tell them stories, and tell them slightly different stories, and then show them how they could convert that into verse and how they could sing it. And then he had to step back and let a thousand flowers bloom. So we've got this amazing oral tradition, which was just as much, it was almost like a fan dance. Now you see it, now you don't. Now you see it, now you don't. Because if he gave all the answers in his first story of Arthur, if he gave all the answers, it would have died in 100 years. Mm-hmm. He had to leave far more questions, far more glimpses than actual pass on reality.
So each bard and troubadour acted almost like the game of telephone that we played when we were children, taking that story, enhancing it to their time, and then sending it on.
And he never insisted on uniformity. And he did not necessarily insist on truth either, but that didn't matter. They were trained in an oral tradition, And so they passed it on. But it went through a very interesting metamorphosis. It left Wales, went to Cornwall, as that was the route that people travelled then, went to Brittany, because the inhabitants of Cornwall at the time and Brittany were identical. And then it moved from Brittany into France. And as it moved through the courts of France, it will come to its greatest flowering in the medieval ages, in the court of Marie de Champagne. Marie had around her a series of troubadours and a man called Crétin de Troyes. I don't speak French, so this won't be right. And then he started to write these stories of the Welsh troubadours down, and as he wrote them down, so the Arthurian legend took on a completely different set of legs and went up through Germany, round France, all the way to Italy. And it invented in the process chivalry. Right. So one of the great sacrifices of the love of Guinevere for Lancelot created a movement which put women on pedestals, and it was the first step, if you like, of women's liberation.
Wonderful. My guest tonight, Carmel Nyland. She's the author of A Darker Magic, This Way Comes, and we'll be back with Carmel and more of the wonderful legend of Arthur and Merlin after these messages on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
What are all the things you witness online in a day? Cats playing piano, selfies on your feed, your friend's picture being turned into a nasty meme that's been shared 50 times? 51. 52. When someone's being bullied online, it's hard to know what to do. Now you can speak up with the witness emoji. It looks like an eye in a speech bubble, and it's in the symbol section near the clocks in your phone. You'll let the world know it isn't cool, and you'll let your friend know you care. Learn more at eyewitnessbullying.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening is Carmel Nyland, author of A Darker Magic, This Way Comes. So at the end of the last segment, you were talking about how the story, the legend of Arthur, the story that Merlin imparted to the bards and traveled through the countries, started out in Cornwall and in the Welsh country, and then migrated into France, into Germany, and the rest of Europe. Please continue that story.
Well, we've then got this wonderful flowering that came around the Renaissance, where the story of Arthur, his knights, of Merlin, of Percival, the quest for the Grail, will reemerge in famous operas, will reemerge in plays, it will reemerge in poetry, it will reemerge in song. And now, where we are at the moment, we're going to see it again early in the new year when Guy Ritchie releases his latest movie, which is called King Arthur and the Legend of the Sword. Mm. So it's still going. So Merlin, the ultimate magician, trickster, released something all those, well, over 1,500 years ago, and it's still blossoming.
That's beautiful and wonderful. A little more on the Arthurian legend. It begins with his father, King Uther Pendragon. Other than literary references, have you found any historical evidence for Uther?
Yes, there is a poem in Welsh which is the death song of Uta Prendragon. And, of course, there is also part of the legend which says Uta. And this is in a number of the documents that were written by early priests or clerics or monks in various monasteries. And they would, once again, tap into the bards, no doubt, but they would pick up what fragments there were, including this particular poem. And this is a poem where he talks about his life. Other than that, we've got a historical reference for him in one of those monks' writings where he talks about a man, Uta, who was tall. And like me, he was redheaded. And he is tumescent with lust for a woman that he has seen who is the wife of the Duke of Cornwall. So she would be the Duchess of Cornwall, which has got a lovely kind of local ring to it. She had hair the colour of ice, and Merlin would use his artifice to get Uther to go into the castle where the, which we would call it a castle, but they would call it a fort, where she lived. He would create through, I would assume by hypnosis, an image for Uta, who was sneaking into this place, that he took on the form of her husband. Mm. And they consummate their passion. And as a result of that consummation, Arthur would be born.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Now, you used a word which most of us Yanks are... the majority of Yanks are not familiar with, which is tumescence, but I can translate that for us on the other side of the pond. That means he was aroused.
Yeah, I think you could even go further than that.
Well, this show actually may have children listening, so I'm not going to. I'm not going to expound beyond that. Now,
used to call it a stiffy.
There you go. Now, what does the name or title Pendragon actually mean?
Pendragon. Pen, which is right throughout Cornwall in goodness knows how many names, like Penzance, means head. And dragon means, in Australia we would call him the boss cocky, but that time he would be the head dragon. So dragon was a person who was militaristic, and he was he could roar. And he gave the impression that he could fly because he could, whether he was on a ship, a boat, or whether he was on a horse, he would be riding ahead of everybody. Now, in Roman times, they had a wind's sock, which was attached to a lance and was carried high. And at the front of the wind sock, the wind goes into the sock at the back, and then out the front, there was a kind of... a head of a dragon, and the air would rush through and it would roar. Now, the Romans used that for great effect, and Pendragon used it as well. There are a lot of stories as to how he got his name. That's one possibility. Another was that at the time of his meeting with Egern, the mother of Arthur, there was a comet with a large tail in the sky. And another one suggests that his son, Arthur himself, saw him in a mask of a dragon in preparation for a party, and he referred to him as Pendragon.
So the concept and the title of Pendragon could be compared to what we would call the commanding general today.
That's right. Yes. And, you know, when I write about him, I'm in writing the second novel at the moment, he leaps off the page. He's around me. I can hear him pacing sometimes, saying, no, this. He's highly directive, but incredibly charming. And his energy just lights the page whenever he's there. Marvelous character, and I'm sure a marvelous person.
I actually was going to ask you about that later, but you brought up a wonderful point. I know a lot of authors who do novels and fiction. When they create their characters, whether they're based on someone in real life or in a historical character, they actually see them as actually living alive, there present with them, and mm-hmm. have conversations with them and have arguments with them. Do you find yourself in that process?
I do, particularly with Uta Pendragon. He doesn't walk, he strides. He doesn't talk, he kind of blasts. He oozes charm, He's always joking. God, I'd like to meet him.
Again, let's keep this PG rated tonight. So getting back to the characters, now we're obviously Merlin is your main focus. Did you find in your studies and research and travels that Merlin was a specific individual or an amalgam of mythical magicians and shamans?
I think the amalgam of mythical shamans. Sorry, we say it differently here. Has been something which has been superimposed on it by our desire to tidy history up. History is really messy, and there are all kinds of things. Children born out of wedlock, names which change their form and their shape, and they change it so quickly, they're like what happens in Australia. In our time, where we've suddenly developed the word post-truth. Merlin, I believe, became a portmanteau word. It became the name of a title. So in ballet, people talk of the greatness of Nureyev. And when there is a young male ballet dancer, they will say, he is like a Nureyev. I think something similar happened with the name Merlin. And other bards, particularly bards who were interested in magic, took it on. So I would say there are at least two famous Merlins. Nikolai Tolstoy, who wrote the book The Quest for Merlin, opted for the second one. Who occurred much later. And that makes no sense at all, because by the time the Merlin he selected is talking about different wars, and these wars were well and truly over at the time that the first Merlin was alive. So I go with the first Merlin, and I don't get him messed with anyone. He is a character even bigger than Uta Pendragon, and I can understand why other people would want to take his name.
Absolutely. The time frame of the legend places it in sub-Roman Britain at a time when pagan practice was slowly being transformed into Christianity. How much were these stories framed as a longing to hold on to the old religion?
I just don't know about the longing to hold on to the old religion. I just think that Celtic Christianity, which is a phrase, had these two things running parallel for hundreds of years. And my grandmother was Irish, and I know from the Christianity that I got from her Irish Catholicism, there were fairies in it, and there was nothing odd about that at all. So if you like, she was born in the 19th century, so it was still there even then. And when one hears songs that are sung in England, one can hear the echoes of it still there. And, of course, Druidic practices still there, still exist. Look at if you go to Glastonbury in Somerset, the whole thing is redolent with Druidism. Mm. If you go to what was the Druids' island, the Isle of Anglesey, which they called Mona, where all the Druids were supposed to have been exterminated in about between 30 and 60 AD. You can still find it there.
My guest, Carmel Nyland, the author of the book, A Darker Magic This Way Comes. Carmel, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
The book is available on Amazon, and it's being distributed slowly into hard copy in the United States.
Wonderful. Our guest, Carmel Nyland, and we'll be back with more of Carmel and the legends of Merlin and Arthur after these messages on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at ascendinghearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest tonight, Carmel Nyland, the author of A Darker Magic This Way Comes. We were talking about the religion, the old religion, the new religion, the combination of the two, and the fact that they kept going on. Let's talk a little bit about the symbolism in the Arthurian legend. Let's talk about the Lady of the Lake. Who is the Lady of the Lake?
Well, I believe... Remember, when you ask a question of an Australian, we tend to be iconoclastic. And I believe she was a good swimmer. Mm. And in those days, there were very few good swimmers around. So if you can get someone who can actually go underwater, hold their breath, and then come out again, particularly with a sword called Excalibur, boy, have you got a winner. That story will last 1,500 years.
What a refreshing take on the story. I think that's fabulous because we all think of the Lady of the Lake in a Christian sense.
Yeah. But I'm postmodern, I suppose, in my approach to the Arthurian legend. I believe in its beauty. I believe in its fable. I believe in its myth. But actually, when you go to the places where the Lady of the Lake was, which I have been to, and you look at it and you think, this pond that she was in is 6 foot deep. Right. Okay. If it's 6 foot deep, she was either very tall or even if she was very short, she would have only had to hold her breath for a very short time and then stick the sword up. So when I write this, I've got to be able to look at it from this particular kind of point of view. It becomes a myth because of its mystery, but through modern eyes, a lot of it is not particularly mythical. For example, we're going to be looking at the moment of the sword and the stone because of this movie that's coming out. And there are many ways that Merlin, who was a brilliant engineer and trickster, could have created the sword in the stone. First of all, he would stand back and say, I've got Arthur here who I've been looking after, and he had to look after him for about 10 years and position him somewhere safe, because in those days, and it's still true today in some cultures, if you could kidnap the son of a king, then you could get an enormous ransom for it. And given that this was a time of invasion and a time of terrible change, in the sense that the Romans had gone and people were hungry, and there was not only poverty, but there was also disease, there was a famine, there was a plague at the time too. How do you actually protect your son? You keep him out of the way. So he gives him to Merlin, who takes him to Wales, probably to one of the Roman forts there. And he stays there and he teaches him for 10 years. And when he reemerges and he is about 15, 16, he cannot inherit the throne from his father, because he was born out of wedlock, and everybody knows that.
Mm.
So he was illegitimate, and you cannot inherit the throne. So you have to create something, and then the trickster is perfectly at work. He works out a sword, which is the symbol of power, and he works out a way to make sure that the sword will stay within a stone and will only be released not when the 500 men who are all trying to pull it out and become King of Britain, but when a particular person does it.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have to wait to read book 3 before that's revealed to you. But what we've got an amazing amalgam here of things happening in the Arthurian legend.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a trickster. We've got tales of love. We've got tales of dedication. We've got tales about courtesy, about perfect truth, about loyalty, courage, adventure, moral temptation. And here we've got a wonderful story about the sword, and how can a man or a young boy get this sword and become King of England.
Mm. Mm. And you talked about the relationships. In your opinion, was the triangle between Arthur, Guinevere, and Lancelot a literary device or based on something historical?
Oh, definitely historical.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. It's just like when one reads Shakespeare, so much of Shakespeare is based on real characters who existed in Elizabethan times. Now, it doesn't mean that the whole character is there, but there's enough of the character that Elizabethan audiences would know that Polonius was the Secretary of State at the time. It's the same there. You work with the real character, Arthur, and you're Merlin thinking about him. But there are little bits you leave ambiguous that gives room for other people to invent.
Mm.
And you mix it a little bit to protect the innocent. But their story is a palpable story. Mm.
Now, what? I'm sorry, go ahead.
The other thing I get clues on is that I'm very interested in reincarnation, and that's one of the themes of the first book. It's which is a story. They're all about the story of the return of Arthur, and if Arthur's coming back, who was he in the first place, and why is he coming back? What are we confronting at the moment in Britain, which is very like what they confronted in the 5th and the 6th century AD.
Mm.
They are confronting a movement of people who are having to leave their country because of war, famine, or because of climate change in those times, because the sea was rising. and all of the people in the low-lying areas of what was called Germanica had to move. And they had two choices. They could either get on a boat and head for Great Britain, or they could go up the river systems and go elsewhere within the European area. And today, Great Britain faces a similar thing. Mm. It faces the movement of people as a result of war and, to some extent, climate change. And a new Arthur will emerge from that. So as I think with those things, I'm very interested in who was Arthur reincarnationally before that, and who was Guinevere and Lancelot, because I always believe that when there is a love, which is like almost at first sight, and it's extremely strong, it's based on and experiences of previous lives that go back 2,000-3,000 years.
Absolutely.
So I began a quest to find out who they were. And for a love story to start so rapidly as that did, and to have such restraint, when you actually think of it, they spent 10 years, at least 10 years, loving one another from the distance and not even touching. And they were in a very dangerous situation because Arthur most of the time was away. He was away, you know, even a year or a year and a half at a time. Where he was fighting, which was in northern England, southern Scotland, is a long way away from where we think Camelot, in inverted commas, was. And during that time, he would have sent his right-hand man, Lancelot, back to check on how things were going back at home base. So we've got enormous restraint in their love affair, but the intensity of it, the greatness of it, suggests an attempt at purity, an attempt at of the great loyalty that Lancelot had to Arthur, the great courage he showed, but he is involved in moral temptation and he fights it and fights it and fights it and fights it, and finally he gives in to the temptation. She does too. And the whole thing came tumbling down.
Mm.
I think the question for us is, what would have happened if they had remained pure and not consummated their relationship? What would have happened then?
Mm.
We wouldn't really have a story. And not only that, Arthur, who was such a fantastic fighter, he was a brilliant tactician. He was physically incredibly strong. He's spoken about in the Welsh triads with awe. You know, they talk about a great hero and they say he was no Arthur, and everybody knew that what that meant. If he wasn't killed, he would have conquered the whole of Europe.
Mm, absolutely. Our guest tonight on excuse me one second. Our guest tonight on Destination Unlimited, Carmel Nyland, author of the book A Darker Magic This Way Comes. And we'll be back with more of Carmel and the Arthurian legend and her take on it in her new book after these messages on the Om Times Radio Network.
The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls Project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi, this is Sylvia Henderson, intuitive life coach and energy healer. Are you ready to elevate and rise way above your normal? Be sure to listen to my show, Intuitive Transformations, on OWN Times Radio, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. Get the inspiration you need to transform your life.
Hope you enjoyed your meal. And I just want to say, he's lucky to have a brother like you.
Lucky? Caring for my brother is far from easy. But he's a part of me, like my arms and legs, so I'll be his. No time for tired. Nothing can disable this love. He needs me, but I'm the lucky one, even though I need help now and then.
If you're caring for a loved one, visit aarp.org/caregiving for care guides and community. Support for your strength. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hello! Join us, Lisa Berry and Michelle Carter, every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the Mindset Makeover, What's Possible? Get ready to become present, clear, and unstuck, and start living fully, led by your heart, while you listen and feel this transformation through vibration of word, sound, and song. You'll open up to what's possible and experience your shift.
Every Tuesday on Living with Moxie, join Shefali Burns and Donna Martouge in conversations designed to take you to the next level, where we highlight ideas, resources, and strategies that provide you with the leverage you require to meet and exceed your business and personal goals. Each week on Living with Moxie, we will lead conversations related to success, achievement, fulfillment, and extraordinary, vibrant living. Are you ready to live with Moxie? Join us.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Carmel Nyland, author of the new book, A Darker Magic This Way Comes. So you started talking a little bit about the plot and the themes that you work with. Why don't you expand for our listeners? Give them a little tease as to what the storyline is about.
Okay. This is a story about long-buried secrets. One of them, that Merlin... The story has two storytellers. It has Merlin speaking in the first person, but it also has the universal way of telling a story where there is a person whose identity you don't know, the author, who's also telling the story and using modern language. But when Arthur speaks, he's a poet. He uses poetry and song quite a lot. He says, "I am Merlin. I weave magic. I engineer battles. I remember the future. I toy with the laws of nature. I fly with my lady hawk on the sky tracks of the air. I am a smith of strangeness."
Mm.
So a smith is a person who could do anything with his hands. He could create with his hands, but he can not only work with metal, which he loves. He can not only build a dam or a bridge. He can not only build the weapons of war, swords, shields, explosives. He can do all of that. But he can also do other things. Merlin is a hypnotist. The main character, the main female character, Emily, because she's modern, she knows that what he's doing is hypnotizing. So we've got a kind of two voices or two ways of looking at this. Firstly, he falls in love with this girl who lives in our time. Right. Now, that is a device that I used because this is a story that Merlin is telling about Arthur, but also about the return of Arthur.
Mm.
So we have to have a vehicle by which Arthur can return. and Emily is the chosen one, but she doesn't know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And she sure as hell is not supposed to be mixed up with Merlin, but she does.
Now, you use the device of time travel in your novel. Why?
So that Merlin can reveal to us long buried secrets,
mm-hmm.
a different take on the Arthurian legend. It's not saying, I'm a writer, I'm not saying necessarily it's total truth, but it's a different truth, a different reality. And this story is a very important story. The story I'm tapping into is a very important story for who we are, the nature of God, how God works on earth. It will, not in the first novel, but ultimately, look at the quest for the Grail. And it's all the time about the birth of Christianity and the places it takes place, one of which is Glastonbury, is all about the birth of British Christianity. And the people who were there, what kinds of links did they have to the original birth of it around the table, for example, at the Last Supper? That is a critical theme that goes throughout all the five novels. The story, the poem of that many British people sing at soccer games, which is called Jerusalem, is the story about, did Jesus come with his uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, to Britain in his lifetime? And did he ask his uncle, Joseph, to return to Britain, taking with him perhaps the Grail, or even temporarily taking the Grail? And how has that actually affected the approach to Christianity in Britain?
Mm-hmm.
So we start with those things. And when Merlin sees Emily for the first time, she's dancing on a moor, and she's dancing around stone maidens. And that takes us back into the Druidic, the ancient past of Britain and the mystery of it. And it introduces us to a very devious character called Morgana. The name Morgana is used in this novel even though she hasn't been born yet.
Mm.
To give her another name is too difficult. And her name, anyway, she keeps is secret, and that is part of the plot.
Now, many of the characters in your book we talked about before are modeled after either people they know personally or historical figures that they admired. You had mentioned Merlin as a Leonardo da Vinci type character. Who is your heroine Emily based upon?
My niece.
Ah.
I have her, a beautiful girl who has been living in England and just returned here for about 10 years. And I just don't make any problem about it. I mean, she's got the same name. She has her intellect, her beauty. She can dance. She's a gymnast. And just like the Emily in the novel, what did she want to be? She wanted to be a social worker. And she worked in Brixton, one of the most challenging jobs in the world and the most looked down upon as do-gooders and saviors. For some years, I ran the department in my state, which was concerned with child protection, and it was the most thankless, complex kind of thing. So I had a girl who was magical in the sense of She was physically beautiful. She was capable of dancing. She was gymnastically acute. She, at the same time, her heart was so big that she was involved in child protection in one of the most challenging parts of London, Brixton. So she was a perfect model for Emily. And Merlin takes one look at her, his soul changes colour when he sees her dancing on Dartmoor, and it's love at first sight.
Beautiful. A Darker Magic This Way Comes revolves more around the powerful feminine characters rather than the men. Why did you choose that trope?
I chose that trope because what will happen as one gets further into the Arthurian story, well, you will find it dominated by the male characters, who are absolutely fascinating and every reason they should dominate. But in order to understand the whole of their humanity, we have to either know their mothers, their sisters, or their lovers, so one can see the full side of these great people. And I needed strong female characters to provide the way that girls who read probably, compared to boys, 75% of my audience will be female and 25% of it will be male, not because I don't have strong male characters, but girls are the readers.
Mm-hmm.
And they need the role models.
I'm sorry, I talked over saying that again.
They need the role models.
They need the role models, absolutely.
They need to be able to read. Remember, I'm first and foremost a teacher.
Right.
And my class in Ithaca, of my 8th graders, 9th graders, and 10th graders, they needed strong female role models so they could learn to be all they could be.
Absolutely.
So that's why the female characters have got to be mothers, they've got to be sorceresses, they've got to be leaders, they've got to be able to fight. They've got to have the full diversity of roles that were open to women at that time.
When all is said and done, what lessons can we learn from the glorious age to turn our world back into a place of magic, compassion, and love?
Oh, boy. Do we need it at the moment?
Absolutely. What would you like to see?
Well, what I'm trying to do is inspire young people and let them know present them with role models who they can emulate, but also so they can understand that there is far more than there is far more in our reality than what we are told scientifically is in our reality.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
And therefore, I've got to show them working models of how that possibility could be. Okay, Merlin flies.
Mm.
He will actually tell you the physics and the science of how he flies. But the thing is, he could fly. And he could speak with animals. He could understand animals. He could understand trees. We're just beginning now in our literature to be able to understand how he actually did that. But he will explain how he did that. So you'll not only get the mystery, but for those people who are really scientifically interested, who want to know how, he will actually explain how. Because he wants to. He wants to not know him as only a Smith of strangeness, but there are all of these other possibilities. He will explain, for example, how a turtle that leaves a beach in Australia can end up back in that beach in Australia. And a turtle who's taken off that beach in Australia before he actually comes out of the egg and kept in a scientific experiment and released into the sea in Antarctica can find his way back to that same beach.
Absolutely.
So these are the mysteries and wonders, and these are the things that that Merlin works with on a daily basis.
Our guest, Carmel Nyland, author of A Darker Magic This Way Comes, book one or part one of the Merlin's Secret series. Carmel, please tell our listeners one more time how they can find your book and more about you.
There is a website called A Darker Magic This Way Comes. That is a doorway into how one can get the book. And you can buy it through Amazon, and it will be available in some bookstores as well. And on that, you can meet me there.
Wonderful. Carmel, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this wonderful knowledge of a time in the world that we wish we could bring forward now, because God knows we need it right now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Victor.
And thank you all for joining us on this edition of Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next week. Good night now.